Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute also offers week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Public Education Problems Magnified in an Election Year. And today's guest is the Vice President of the National Education Association, Lily Eskelson. Lily Eskelson was an elementary school teacher from Utah, is vice president of the National Education Association. She is one of the highest-ranked labor leaders in the country and one of its most influential Hispanic educators. President Obama recently appointed Lily to the White House Initiative on Education Excellence for Hispanics, whose goal is to expand education opportunities and improve education outcomes for Hispanic students. She is one of 30 leaders from the education, labor, philanthropic and nonprofit sectors to serve on this national commission. She began her career in education as a lunch worker in a school cafeteria. She became a kindergarten aide and was encouraged by a teacher to go to college and become a teacher herself. She worked her way through the University of Utah on scholarships, student loans, and as a starving folk singer. Graduating magna cum laude in elementary education and later earning her master's degree in instructional technology. After teaching only 9 years, she was named Utah Teacher of the Year. A year later, she was elected president of the Utah Education Association and was later appointed a member of the White House Strategy Session on Improving Hispanic Education. She has been invited to be a keynote speaker for hundreds of education events in virtually every state, earning her recognition by Education World in their Best Conference Speakers edition. She believes that no matter how students arrive, and no matter what their learning conditions, their home conditions, or their health conditions, that educators have the sacred duty to be professionals and to care for the whole child. And she believes that professionalism carries the responsibility to take action individually and collectively to fight to make the promise of public education a reality and to prepare every student to succeed. With that, please join with me in welcoming our guest, Lily Eskelson.
It is so good to be back at the Hinckley Institute. I think, Mr. Tim, that you asked me here when I lost my mind several years ago and I ran for Congress against, I can't remember, what was his name? Okay. And I ran on the platform that being an elementary teacher and working 20 years with 12-year-olds was the perfect preparation for working with Congress. And I mean no disrespect to 12-year-olds, but this is a very special room for me because it has some of my heroes on the wall, and J.D., I still miss him. But can I just say there's a little gender inequity here? We're going to work on that? All right. I would look so good on this wall, so I want you to really think about that. I, as you can see, do not take myself too seriously. I take my work like my religion. My work is to advocate for the whole blessed, happy human child. And to do that, I found out I had to not only do everything I could in my classroom, I had to leave my classroom. I had to talk to the public. I had to talk to the League of Women Voters and the Republicans and the Democrats and mayors and legislators and presidents. I had to explain to all the people that are making decisions for what happens in my classroom. I had to somehow give them a sense of what it was that we do in that classroom, preschool to graduate school. Education is politics. Politics will determine whether or not you have a seat to sit on in this room, whether or not the lights get turned on, whether or not your teachers get a paycheck, whether or not you have affordable college, whether or not in your high school you had a pipeline to the classes that led you here. Whether or not, if you spoke English, you were going to get what you needed so that you could succeed. And maybe what you needed was a Head Start program so that, oh, you are so going to hell. That is. That's okay. Once that happened and it was my phone in my purse that I had forgotten to turn off. So, okay, I forgive you. But I didn't really realize that until I became a teacher. I wanted to teach. I wanted to teach young kids. And I did start out as the lunch lady. And I loved being a lunch lady. I was an incredible lunch lady because I didn't know the kids' names. And so when they'd come through my line, I just, you know, I like to make them laugh. So I just made nicknames up for them, you know, like, hey, Superman, eat those peas. Hey, cutie poop, I want to see that milk gone. And then there was an opening as a kindergarten aide. And I went, oh, I want to work with the kids. And the principal let me have this job as a kindergarten aide. And I'd bring my guitar. And my kids knew all the words to the classic, don't stick your finger up your nose because your nose knows it's not the place it goes. And we sang it with dignity. And the teacher said, you know, you're really good with these kids. I was 20 years old. She said, have you ever thought about going to college and becoming a teacher? That was the first time in my life anyone had suggested I might go to college. No one in my family had ever gone to college. My parents had never gone to college. And so they were really happy. You graduated from college. You got married. Great. You know, go forth and have babies and you're done. And all of a sudden I have this teacher saying, have you ever thought about going to college? Wow, I could so do that. And my husband and I came up to the University of Utah on scholarships and the GI Bill and a six-month-old in tow, you know, eating cigarette butts off the student union building. It was, yes. It was just an incredible thing. Education was everything to me, and I wanted to work in education. And then I found out that if you're not involved in politics, you end up with 39 fifth graders in your classroom. And you end up with people saying, the class size doesn't matter. If you say that to a Utah teacher and you're standing too close, it's a dangerous place to be. Mm-hmm. Because those of us that had 39, 40, 42 kids, I knew a kindergarten teacher in St. George, 52 kindergarten students, because some politician thought class size doesn't matter. And she cried on my shoulder because of what she couldn't give her students. And she wondered if she wanted to keep being a teacher, if nobody else cared. These are all things that you deal with when you belong to the association. I belong to the Granite Education Association, the Utah Education Association, the National Education Association. And now it is my mission to go out and to talk to people about what's happening in our classrooms and why we need the public's support. I apparently offended the president of the National Education Association because he sends me to all the conservative events that he can possibly send me to. And he said, first of all, you're from Utah, so reddest of the red states. You can go out there and you can talk conservative to people. That's a language. I'm bilingual. And help these people understand we're not the enemy. Help them understand that everything we hope to accomplish in this country is going to be based on whether or not we invested properly in our public schools, colleges, and universities. And so I was put on this panel discussion with the American Enterprise Institute, very conservative, very libertarian, pro-privatization everything. They have this like yoga class where they sit in the lotus position, you know, inhaling incense, mm-hmm. saying, public bad, private good, public bad, private good, you know, namaste. And I was supposed to get in front of these people and talk about what we needed in public schools when what they were saying what we needed was something called choice and vouchers, and we just give parents a couple of $1,000 and we wish them well in this big marketplace where some kid who doesn't speak English and has disabilities can just walk into some elite private school with their $2,000 or $3,000 voucher, and everything will be just fine. Well, we know they won't be just fine. We know that this is medically stupid. So I had to get in front of these folks, and the topic of this panel was how to do more with less. That's creative. Yeah, never heard that one before. And there's this wonderful distinguished panel of people with, you know, PhDs and doctors in front of their names. And somebody got up and explained that according to standardized tests, class size doesn't matter. And so we could just save a lot of money if we didn't hire as many teachers. Because you can put 40 or 50 or 87,000 kids in a classroom. It doesn't matter. And some other person got up and said, you know, what we should do is put it all online. If we put it all online, we could have 40 or 70 or 80,000 people online. And class size wouldn't matter. We wouldn't have to hire real teachers. And then we wouldn't have to pay benefits and these exotic things called pensions. And so we could just, like, destroy pension plans and not hire teachers. And what do you know? It'd be just fine. And then I'm supposed to get up and be the person, you know, who says, well, here's what NEA thinks we could do less of so we could do more. And I got up and I said, okay, I get this less part. I get that you're telling us we should just accept without question that you intend to keep giving education less, that it's less money you're talking about. You didn't say it, but I'm guessing less money because you gave it in huge tax giveaways to the Walmart that is going to come in and promise all kinds of economic development that never happens. But you've given away all the tax dollars in these huge mega tax giveaways under the guise of economic development. And you want us to believe that you are not going to reverse that. You are not going to ask mega corporations to pay their fair share. So the revenue is gone. And now you want Utah teachers to do more. Okay, it's the more part that I'm interested in. Do more what? Do more what exactly? What is it you think I do that you want me to do more of? Because if you want me to do more, oh, I don't know, you want more points on a commercial standardized test, wow, como si nada, I can do that in my sleep, okay? Because you know what? I could just make sure I push out enough kids that don't speak English. My test scores will go up like that overnight. I could push out poor kids before they take the test. I could push out kids that have disabilities. My test scores will go up overnight. If I don't mind hurting a few kids, targeted kids, I can do that. And boy, if you tell me I'm going to get a prize, a paycheck, a bonus, because my test scores went up on paper, then yeah, I can do that. And you will have changed and corrupted what it means to teach and what it means to learn forever. Now, if you want me to do more, you have to start with the basic premise of understanding what the purpose of public education is. You didn't start the conversation with, by the way, here's the purpose, here's what we're trying to achieve, now how do we move towards that? So if you want to tell me that the purpose of public education is a standardized test score, we can't have that conversation. You didn't tell me the purpose of public education, and you didn't have to. There was never a day that I walked into my classroom where I did not know to my core, to my soul, what my purpose was in standing up in front of my students. My purpose was to open their minds to their infinite possibilities. Now, you want me to do more of that? I will kiss you on the lips. That is what I'm talking about. I want to do more of that. So here's what I'm going to need more. I'm actually going to need more, okay? I am going to need a deep and relevant curriculum. I'm going to need literature and the arts and sports and poetry and auto mechanics and AP calculus. I'm going to need more everything because I don't know exactly what my students are going to need from me today. So I need more if you want more from my students. I want more time with parents. I especially want more time with parents who might not have had a lot of educational opportunities themselves. They won't understand that pipeline of classes that can get their kids into a university, into a trade school or a tech school. I want more time with parents so they can understand how maybe something that seems like an insurmountable dream, like affordable college, where maybe they can find out where they can get scholarships and grants and loans. I want more time with my colleagues. You know, I had this incredible faculty at Douglas T. Orchard Elementary in West Valley City, and we would sit around and we would just complain and complain and complain about what was going wrong and what this kid was doing and why these parents were. But we'd always stop and we would talk amongst ourselves and go, but you know, I had his big brother, and here's how you can work with his parents. They really respond to this. And this kid, I had his little sister, and try this. And we would start to work with each other about solutions. We were so lucky that we had that, and luck is a lousy business plan. I want something that's structured into my day so that I can collaborate with my colleagues. We never get to talk with each other. We teach in these little silos. There's so much more I want. And I talked with these poor people, and the timekeeper, I know we have one here, I'll be ignoring you, but the timekeeper's just jumping up going, stop, 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 stop. I couldn't stop any more than I'm going to stop talking to you. This is all so important. There's somebody's kid that's going to walk into a classroom tomorrow. And they're not going to have everything they need. The one thing that we can guarantee them, my members of the NEA, the UEA, is we can guarantee them that whatever we've been given, we're going to give them 110% of what's in us. We are not going to accept any excuse. So I had 39 kids. I still taught. It wasn't easy to personalize things the way I wanted to, but I did everything I possibly could and then a little bit more. You can always do a little bit more. That's the other thing I do, and I go around and I talk to our teachers about doing a little bit more, even as they're being given less. And it makes a difference. Sometimes they just need to hear somebody who's on their side. A lot of politicians are not on their side. A lot of politicians dismiss them because they don't have doctor in front of their name, because they're not wealthy. I searched the NEA membership database. You would be shocked to learn how few millionaires work in an American public school, college, or university. I was totally shocked. We don't have any millionaires. We have millions and millions of really good people who come together. They become members of a union, the National Education Association. And it's only in our numbers and in coming together that any politician ever wants to give us the time of day, Democrat or Republican. So when I go and I talk to Senator Hatch and Senator Bennett before him, when I go and I talk to Governor Bangeter, boy, does that age me, Governor Bangeter and Governor Leavitt when I was president of the Utah Education Association, they picked up the phone. They met one-on-one with me, and they said, okay, where are we in trouble? Where can we do something together? We're not going to agree on everything. But what are we going to move on this year? And they would try and find something that we could work together on. We were always able to work with reasonable people. I'm frightened. I'm frightened by the polarization that we're seeing in politics. I'm frightened that I had no trouble talking to a Republican Governor Bangeter about class size, and we actually got class size money from one of the most conservative governors in this state. Because he didn't think of conservative as anti-education. He might have said, we don't have the money. Well, we showed him where we could concentrate. Let's do first class, first grade. Let's just do first grade. And he said, you'd be satisfied with just cutting class size in first grade? No, of course not. But we want to begin somewhere. Next year, we're coming up here, and we're going to bang on your door for second grade. And he knew that was coming, and he said, all right, I'll work with you. More and more now, you're finding people who have demonized educators. They've demonized people like me. They've said the only reason I get up in the morning is to protect bad teachers. And they say it over and over again, hoping that you will believe it. I am thrilled that the latest Gallup poll ask the question, do you trust America's teachers? 75% of rank-and-file Americans said, yes, I absolutely trust America's teachers. That's after all the beatings that we've received over the years. Movies that make us the villain. 75% still say, no, I believe these teachers are here for the kids. And they're right. That's the only power we have. We're trusted, we're respected, and there's lots of us. And because of that, we put that to use in a political world and try and get people on our side. Preschool to graduate school. I'm going to leave it at that. I can do this forever. But you have homework to do too, and you're supposed to ask wonderful questions. If I like them, I'll answer them. It'll be like the debates, you know. Did you notice that? It's like, I don't like that question, so I'll be answering the other one. But I'll try very hard to help you understand what we're doing, what we're trying to accomplish. Questions? Yeah.
Hi, my name's Chase Hunziker. You said that the standardized testing for like a performance bonus was a bad idea because you could like, you know, just weed out the bad students, basically. They got bad test scores. As I grew up through elementary, through high school, I noticed that I felt like some of my teachers actually cared about me, and I felt like others were there just for the paycheck. How would you suggest then to be a better performance pay so that those ones that actually cared about me got paid more compared to those ones that were just there for the paycheck?
You know, that's a question that we get asked a lot. It's not a, you know, 30-second soundbite answer. I know that if we don't come up with the answer, I know what the answer the other guys say. We can tell the good teachers from the bad teachers by their students' test scores. So we're going to give you a bonus for high test scores, and you're going to get fired if you don't get those test scores up by any means necessary. We know that's the wrong answer. I was the teacher of the year, and it had nothing to do with my students' test scores. It had everything to do with what you just said. Because parents said, wow, this teacher really cares about my kid. My kid's doing her homework for the first time because she doesn't want to disappoint the teacher or because there's something exciting going on and she's enjoying learning. So the bottom line is for me, and I was talking to someone on the Chamber of Commerce, and I said, so you want a system that pays the good teachers this much and the bad teachers this much? And he said, yes. I said, we want a system that pays the good teachers this much and the bad teachers nothing. Why in the world would you give a bad teacher a paycheck? If you are a bad teacher, get out. I talked to a woman from Finland who works for their Department of Education, Finland, with the test scores up. And I said, okay, everybody was making a beeline to the Finnish delegation to this international conference. And when I finally got up to her and I said, I just have a few questions. She said, please don't ask me the secret formula for our students doing so. She said, it's not the reindeer milk. But she, you know, first of all, you know, I said, well, we're struggling to answer the question you just asked. How do you evaluate quality? How do you, you know, I said, bottom line, how do you remove a bad teacher in Finland? And she just stared at me. And she said, are you telling me you have a system that allows you to hire a bad teacher? Whoa. I mean, my mind just went, whoa. Because in my union, I know when I got my job teaching, I interviewed with the principal. He said, you're hired. I go into my fourth grade classroom. I'm putting up bulletin boards. And the teacher across the hall comes in and welcomes me. And she says, oh, I'm the association rep this year. And would you like to join the UEA? And here's the membership form. And I signed it. So my union started representing me when I started teaching, not before. There was nothing when I was a student here. There was nothing that said, is there some responsibility for the union that you would have a system that didn't allow a bad teacher, someone who was not prepared, to be hired? That was something we'd never thought of, our responsibility on the front end of training, preparation, and even who gets hired. So what we've been looking at now is something that's much more systemic. It's not enough to say, if I've got an evaluation system after you're already in, how do we make sure, first of all, that no one is allowed in front of those students until they are properly prepared, mentored, monitored, assessed that they are good teachers? After that, you have to have a good evaluation tool. And a good evaluation tool is going to be multi-dimensional. You're going to have multi-evidence of quality. There is actually a national board certification evaluation that NEA helped to develop with a foundation. It's the best teacher evaluation possible. You do videotape of showing a lesson. You show evidence of your students' learning, but it's not necessarily a standardized test. If you're an AP chemistry teacher, there's an AP chemistry test. It is a standardized test, and it makes sense to use that. If you're a special ed teacher, a music teacher, a third grade teacher, teaching everything, it doesn't make any sense. So what they've developed is a portfolio of your students' progress. Observations, but observations not just of principals, but of your peers, peers who know you and peers who don't know you, people who teach your subject. And it is this incredible evaluation system. Teachers who have received National Board certification in several states, we've actually promoted that they should be seen as master teachers and that they should get more money for achieving this incredible state. It means that they don't have to become administrators in order to make more money. They don't have to leave their classrooms. And a lot of states like North Carolina have done that. So we're seeing evidence that there are ways that you can reward excellence that doesn't actually corrupt the teaching process.
Hello. I'm Stephen Goodwill, and I have a question. You mentioned your stance on the voucher program, and could you elaborate on that? What particular problems do you see in the voucher program, and why do you criticize it?
Oh, you don't have enough time. I'm sorry. Let's just talk about the basic fundamental flaw in that program, because it makes a great bumper sticker, I have to admit, when someone goes, who's for choices? Who wants less choices? Nobody. Who wants more choices? Everybody. So first of all, they found a good word, choice. They meaning people who were not particularly fond of funding public education. And this is really the whole basis is we don't have to spend more in education. We just give people a certain voucher, a certain amount of money, and it's usually much less money than a private school charges. I did talk to someone who was very pro-voucher, saying, all right, what if we gave everybody $3,000, $4,000? In Pennsylvania, $7,000. They have a voucher program, $7,000. And then we just say, go wherever you want. Governor Romney has said, all right, federal government pays special education. Only about 20% of the special education costs the federal government pays. They've never paid more than 20%, even though the whole program was based on them paying 40%. They've never fully funded their promise. But he said, what if we just take that little bit of special ed money, we give it to those parents, and we say, go out there and find a private school that wants your special ed child. They get more choices. Okay, so let's say there's four or five special ed kids in Orchard Elementary that take that money, couple of $1,000, what then happens to the rest of the kids in the classroom? Less money. They still need the teacher. A couple of kids leaving doesn't mean that you get a little bit less of a teacher. So the infrastructure costs are the same. They still need to pay the light bill. They still need to pay the teacher. So it's less money for the kids that stay in the public schools. And for those kids that take a couple of $1,000 and go, now I can go to Juan Diego. I can go to the Catholic school. Juan Diego's a lot more money than a couple $1,000. So the parents that actually can use that money are the parents who can make up the difference. which are going to be the richer parents. The parents that have this voucher, it's a ticket to nowhere for most of our kids. Most of those kids, it's going to hurt the kids that stay. It's not going to help necessarily the kids that go. And you have to ask yourself, now, again, go back to purpose. And the purpose is what? Go back to the purpose. So a couple of kids can maybe have a choice. If we're talking about a whole system, what's the purpose of this whole system? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. The math isn't even there. And if the purpose is we need all children to have a quality education, we need all children. That's the purpose. All children get everything they need. Now, how would we build that system? And you look at our competition, the people in the international community, once again, Finland, making a beeline to Finland. So how do you handle choice? How important is choice in you being at the top? Again, she looks at me like I'm crazy. She said, there are no private schools in Finland. I mean, well, like Catholic schools, come on. There are no private schools in Finland. None. They don't exist. So who came up with this? Competition will make us better. Somebody just made that up. There is no research that shows it. All of the research says the top schools, Singapore, Canada, Finland, the people that are like kicking our butts as far as doing well on these standardized tests, which, by the way, the PISA international tests are given on a random sample. You can't really skew it. All they do every few years, it's not someone who's teaching to this PISA test. They really are very high-quality standardized tests. So I have some faith that they are giving us that broad shot. All of the countries that are at the top do the opposite of competition. They say, we look at our schools, we see the system. All kids are our goal. All kids' quality is our goal. And so what they do is they say, we make every public school as good as the best public school. Again, my head flips. Why didn't I think of that? 80% of the richest of the rich Americans in this country send their kids to public school. They could send their kids anywhere. They don't need a voucher. Why would they send their kids to their neighborhood public school? Because they have an incredible public school. It's probably funded by property tax dollars. And so mansions bring in a lot of money. You have the most incredible facilities. You attract the most incredible teachers because you have these highly motivated parents that every one of them, their kid is going to go to an Ivy League school or the University of Utah. And what these other countries have done is they've said the only way we can reach our goal is if every public school is as good as the best public school. We have not done that in this country. We're trying to do it on the cheap. And the cheap is, all right, let's just tell people they have a choice. We give them a couple of $1,000. They stop bothering us. If you don't like the fact that there's 40 kids in your fifth grade, here's a couple thousand. Go find a school that wants you and stop bothering me to fund class size. It's a way to shut people up, and we're not accepting it.
Good morning. My name is Clint Williams. I'm a third-year economics student. I feel like you've somewhat answered my question a little bit, but I'll still throw it at you anyway. Which, in all your travels, which educational model would you say would be your favorite that you feel like works best, whether it be here in the States or abroad?
I am updating my passport so that I can go move to Finland. Oh, my God. I mean, if you were to take a look at their system, because they've actually looked at a system, preschool to graduate school. They look at you as part of the public education system because you're in the higher education part of this pipeline to success. And I've had other people who've said, "Yeah, you can't look at Finland," all right? Because Finland's not the United States. They don't have the diversity. They've got a little tiny population, 4 million people in the entire country. They don't have the language barriers. They don't have the immigration problems. But I looked it up because I have a Google. They weren't always at the top. They were kind of mediocre 20, 25 years ago. Nobody was singing the praises of Finland. What shot them to the top 20 years later? What did they do? That's what I asked this lady. I said, all right, you were right here, nothing special. And now you're up here and everyone's going, well, I said Finland, and I saw heads go, yeah, there's Finland. Okay, how did you get so cool? And she said, we have very few natural resources. We don't have gold mines, diamond mines. We don't have oil in our backyard. We have brains. We have our people. They are our only natural resource. Whatever we do with our children becomes our future. And we see that in a very practical way. It is not poetry to us. It is dollars and cents. It is our economic development plan. And so we sat back and we said, we're not knocking the socks off anybody. And we have to if we're to compete with the United States, with China, with Russia. So they said, what we are going to do is we are going to build the finest education pipeline in the world. They decided deliberately to do that. And they looked around and they said, first of all, we don't have a lot of income inequality. We can't say that. So in Finland, there are poor people, but there are not people living on the street poor people. There are rich people, but there are not Koch brother rich people where they can buy small countries, medium-sized countries. Actually, they bought our country. So she said, we worked with that, and we decided if you did not have all the advantages that, say, a family that has two parents who are both well-educated, and so they're able to, you know, give their kids that kind of foresight into what their futures could look like and guiding their kids into this college pipeline, she said, we start with preschool. Our high school graduation plan starts with preschool. They really do look at it systemically. And so she said, everything is free. Yes, our taxes pay for it, and our taxes are relatively high, and nobody complains about it because we are able to show them results, which goes back to what you were saying. You have to have something you can show them. And it's not, she said, the first thing we did was we got rid of all standardized tests. So this woman on, you know, one sentence, she's saying we have to show them results, and it's certainly not going to be one of those stupid standardized tests. So, again, she's like rocking my world. They based everything they did on research. They, without, you know, some political agenda, without some ideology that it has to be private and you have to have competition, you have to have prizes for winners and, you know, gongs for losers that you got fired. They didn't just say, that sounds good. That's the way I'd run my business. They went, what does the research say? The research says you start with early childhood education. The research says, she said, we don't have particularly low class sizes. It's not like we have 12 kids in a classroom, but what we have are 25 kids, and so we have reasonable class sizes. But where we really put our money was not necessarily, you know, real low class sizes. She says we put our money in teacher training. It is harder to get into our college of education than to get into our law school. On this university campus, on every university campus in America, the College of Education is the cash cow. You know how hard it was for me to get into Milton Benyon Hall, to get into the College of Education? I went, I'd like to be a teacher. Great, here, sign this letter. You think that's how you get into engineering school? You think that's how you get into medical school or law school? They said, we make it harder to get into the College of Education than any other profession. We want the best parents, you know, like, announce it to the world when their kid gets into teacher college. We make it a high, visible, professional attainment. And she said, you have to have a master's degree. You have to have done a residency under a trained master teacher before they will let you, again, how do you make sure you don't hire a bad teacher, before we will let you into a classroom in front of your own students. It is so well prepared. We have incredible professional development. We have built-in collaboration. And we let the teachers design. Here's the standards. We have standards. Here's what every sixth grader needs to know and be able to do. Now you design the learning environment. You pick the textbooks. You design your testing. And you have to work with your colleagues, and they have to approve what you're doing. Not this big, faceless, one-size-fits-all thing. But you do have – the people looking over your shoulder are your colleagues who demand excellence from you. And this is where they are. So I don't have to – it's not a utopia. It's real, and it's there. And politicians, liberals, and conservatives claim it. And we are doing the exact opposite on every level than the people they told us were our competition. Tell me that makes any sense.
My name is Corey Walsh. What educational ground have you gained in the last couple of years, and what are you guys working for?
That's a good question. Easier to say what we're working for, because with the economy, we've lost ground in a lot of ways. But what we're working for really, if I could sum it up in one phrase, is we really are working on that focus of the whole child. When you talk about education coming down, sometimes for Democrats and Republicans on both sides, we'll say, yeah, but we've got to see what you're doing. And the only thing that we can think of is a test score, a standardized test score in reading and math. Okay? So, again, they want us to accept that premise that that means success, and we won't. The ground that we've, I think, been plowing and that we're seeing some things come up is it's taken us a long time as a union, as an association, to really believe we can't do this alone. We've said it before, teachers can't do it alone, but we really think we can. You know, we really think, but here's the world we know. We know the association. So the association will have a rally. The association will go up and talk to the governor. The association will have a press conference. So we are starting to listen to ourselves, say, but you can't do it without the public. And who's the public? The public are the parents, but the public is also the business community that want to hire the folks that come out of a school. They want to hire you. And they want to know that we gave you something of value that they can then say, all right, that's what I want in my company. I want to take advantage of these skills and these wonderful, smart people that are in my company or my work. We're starting to say we have to build bridges. We have to build bridges into the business community, into the parents, into the advocacy groups. We're building bridges into immigration rights groups because the DREAM Act is such an important part of what we do with the students that are still in public school and the students that are in and want to be in higher education. So we can't just have a position on something. What are we doing to build those bridges so that it's not just a Gallup poll that when people say, do you trust teachers? They go, yeah, we love teachers. Would you work for them? Would you help them? Would you speak with them? Would you stand with them? I think we're seeing that we're building ground with more and more organizing the public to be advocates with us.
My name is Jake Neal. I'm a social science education major. My question for you, well, obviously, like, this whole thing that you're talking about Finland sounds like educational heaven to me.
I know!
That sounds like just an absolutely wonderful program. But what's being done here in, like, Utah or in the nation as a whole to keep teachers as teachers? Because mm-hmm. there's a very high turnover rate for teachers at the moment. I've heard here in Utah figures of 3 years and 5 years, and that just blows my mind. So what's being done to keep teachers as teachers?
An awful lot is being done to cause what you just said, the churning. And some of that is done on purpose, believe it or not. We have these little things that everyone used to have. I mean, anybody that worked for, you know, a big or small company had a pension. They had, and you know, so I'm a Utah teacher, so after 30 years, I could get, you know, 60% of my salary for the rest of my life as a pension, you know, and people put money into a pension, and it helps. It's like Social Security, but it's in a little, you know, big savings account. An awful lot of people in the conservative circles these days would like to, again, turn that almost into a voucher, like a 401k. You put some money in, and then when you retire, you can take the money out. And I hope you don't outlive it. I hope, you know, I hope that you don't lose it in a stock market crash. And so public employees are like the only people left with this little pension thing. It has helped us keep teachers to say, you know, once you're in this system and you stay in for 30 years, you can have a modest $25,000 a year, maybe, that would supplement your Social Security and that sort of thing. And there are an awful lot of teachers who would say, you know, the security, I like that. And I love working with kids and I'll stay. Once you start eroding something that says stay for 30 years, more people will say, but I can make more money in an awful lot of different ways. We've never been able to offer teachers the money that can keep them in. So the pension has helped be that, you know, that magnet that keeps them. And we're eroding that magnet. There's another group. Anyone know what Teach for America is? Anybody Teach for America? I love Teach for America teachers. I don't love the program. The people that are Teach for America, they're usually like the best and brightest, you know, top students, and they get recruited to be Teach for America. But it's like the Peace Corps. And so it's take your, you know, skills in math, economics, science, literature, and go into inner city Los Angeles and work in those gang-infested, you know, places. You have to have a really good heart to want to do that. But they're usually not highly prepared to teach. They're highly prepared in their subject, and then they take a little boot camp, how to be a teacher. They go out there, and 2 years, they only promise to teach for 2 years, and then they go to engineering school and law school and all the wonderful things that they planned on doing with their lives. I actually had someone say, maybe we should all have Teach for America teachers, which would mean that you only had new teachers in a school, that you churned them constantly. Tell me any business that has a business plan that says, I'll never have experienced people working for me. It's a bad business plan. And I know for the Teach for America folks, I love them because they love, they want to do something good and they want to give back. But I talked to one young woman and she said, it was the best teaching experience I ever had. It changed my life. And I said, I don't care about your life. It's not about you. Were you the best teaching experience those kids ever had? Did you change their lives? Or were you practicing on them? Because they needed the best. And was that you? And that's the only thing I'm asking. There are so many people that have, like, it sounds good on paper plans, but one of the plans, one of the things that Finland did was they said experience counts. And so we want to keep experienced teachers in the classroom continually developing those skills. They were telling me, they said, something that says we give anybody an alternative route to certification. She said, Teach for America in Finland would be considered heresy, that you would put someone who was not properly prepared in front of those students. So again, we keep trying these things that have no basis in research or experience. If we go back, we look at preparation, getting the finest people, the best minds to want to become teachers, making it prestigious to become a teacher, and then they'll want to stay. Make it worth their while to stay.
Sorry, apparently it doesn't stretch. My name is Jennifer Indo. I work here at the University of Utah for Education and Community Partnerships for Diversity. And I've been in education all of my life. I'm a classroom baby. My mom was a first grade teacher for 13 years. I've been through Bennett, Bangor, Orrin Hatch. Fun. Actually, now my little one is with me due to UEA. She's starting to be a classroom baby, too.
All right.
I believe in teachers. I do not enjoy the movies that continually tell us that they're the problem. I think it's problematic. But I am wondering, on a policy and advocacy standpoint, in America, in our public education system, for our students, you know, ages 1 to 18, we have at least 47% of them are individuals of color. In our high poverty and high minority schools, not just within urban but rural districts as well, we have some of the most underqualified, high turnover rates in teachers. And overwhelmingly, our teachers are still middle-class white women. In a country that has a minority population that is vastly and very rapidly outgrowing the white student in a classroom, where is that advocacy? Where is that policy when it comes to having a reflection of individuals of color within the classroom teaching their students to that whole student pedagogy? Where is that advocacy coming from in terms of the National Association for Teachers? And I understand the advocating for the whole student and looking at the whole student is very important, but when you're still not even getting the highly qualified teacher to stay in the classroom or even recruiting them, and those measures of developing teacher teacher proficiency. Mm-hmm. Those are still standards that are out there, but they're not being required implementation. What can we see going forward? Where can we see a leadership from an association that is there supposed to be for teachers rather than just having a UEA break where students are home and parents that work have to figure out what to do with them?
One of the things, I wish that you, I'm glad you're here because you're in class and you need the credit, and because Tim would be very upset with you if you had an empty classroom, especially with a great speaker like me. But I wish you could go down to the UEA conference right now. It is full of people who are right now in workshops and different places learning what they can learn. Part of the program is on cultural competency. Part of the program is teaching teachers how to not only teach the whole child, but these days that means the whole family, include the whole family, the whole community. We have worked very hard on the national level to explain to educators, to explain to politicians why it is important to have a faculty reflect the community that those students are coming from, that the faculty should be as diverse as the community, and that the community, the school board, should have an affirmative, yes, affirmative action, affirmative plan to draw in diversity on their faculty. You need to be deliberately diverse. It doesn't just happen. And one of the things that we look at is that ultra-liberal left-wing organization that has always been the model of affirmative action, the U.S. Army. Yes, the U.S. Army has been a model for diversity and it started with Eisenhower. It started with General Eisenhower. As troops are being desegregated, he said, and it's not going to work if we only see minority faces in the kitchens as cooks and never as officers. And so they would go out and tap people on the shoulder and say, you're smart, you're bright, you're a recruit, and would you like to be an officer's candidate school? Would you like to go into a university and be in our ROTC program? What they didn't offer them more money for being a minority. What they offered them was free education. If you really wanted to do something very affirmative, and this is NEA's suggestion that we have made and put in different minds, again, Republican and Democrat, that if we want to see that diversity on faculties, you have to be able to go out into communities and say, "You speak Spanish. That is an incredible asset in our in a faculty in a school. And if you're interested in becoming a teacher, we have a full ride scholarship for you, or we have a loan forgiveness program for you." The same thing when they talk about we don't have enough math teachers, we don't have enough science teachers. Why can't you go out and offer people full ride scholarships or loan forgiveness programs if they will agree to teach in an inner city school, in a high poverty area community, if they speak a foreign language for that particular community? Why not use the power of persuading someone as they're trying to make up their mind what they want to study at a university? There are ways that you can make something like this happen. And again, we know what works because we can see the working models, in this case, the U.S. Army.
My name is Adrienne Chris, and I'm a first-year social work major. And I was wondering what you think might be how we could improve the tenure system to improve our teachers that we have and to funnel in better teachers and make sure that we have them in our public school system.
Right. The tenure, that's such a confusing word because a lot of people who think tenure, they think university tenure. University tenure is peer-driven. Your peers, you know, you have to reach certain levels, and then your peers decide whether or not you get tenure or not. And K-12 schools, whenever they talk about that, we certainly don't have like a peer-driven tenure system the way higher ed does. I asked a reporter on Fox News, I said, what, because she was asking me very much, you know, we need to get rid of tenure, was what she said. And I went, what does that word mean to you? And she says, it means you can never be fired. I went, yes, if we ever had that, we would want to get rid of it. But that's not what we have. For teachers in Utah, we have a orderly termination law that says once you've taught for 2 years, then a principal can't fire you without cause. They have to, you know, competence, I've got, you know, parents are upset, and you have a right to challenge if you say, I think you wanted to get rid of me because you don't like my race, religion, gender, you have a friend that you promised my job to, you know, you promised a position, so you made way for that person. By the way, that happens. So you have a right to challenge that in front of a hearing officer. That's all we have. Now, when people say, well, then how come we don't get rid of more teachers? I have one friend at the American Enterprise Institute. I actually have a friend at the American Enterprise Institute. But, you know, he was saying, all right, he told me he would judge a tenure reform by how many people it fired. You know, so I explained that Helena, Montana, and Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and places in Florida are all talking about ways to improve their teacher evaluation system and a system that would remove someone who doesn't cut the standards. And he said, well, how many people got fired under that in Helena? How many people were shown the door? And that's what you're looking at, you know, but how many people got fired? How about how many people said, I can't pass these standards, so I'm, you know, left. You can't just say how many people got fired. There are some amazing things happening that are union-led, talking about how do we make sure that we are responsible for quality within our own ranks. If you have a system that says it really is awfully hard to fire someone who maybe should have never been hired in the first place. Then we are going back and we're saying, how do you shorten that time length? How do you make sure you've got your due process? This is America. Everybody gets to have due process. But you don't want something that lasts years. It's not fair to the teacher, and it's not fair to the system either. So we are looking at all of those things, local, state, and national. And we're starting at NEA to build a we're actually building a model that says, here are the reforms that are union-led that say, we want to be in charge of quality and making sure that good people stay and that people who can't or won't do the job go. And now we want to take it one step further and say, we also want to take responsibility on who should never be hired in the first place, and to work with administrators, to work with school boards, because we can't do that. I mean, what we want to do is to put in place something that makes sense for everybody. And we're seeing our unions take a very, very different look at our responsibility. And everything that we're looking at is, how does that help this whole child? You're waving at me.